This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Some Wittertainment, the last of the year. There's a best of the films of the year coming up on New Year's Day. Then we're back on the 8th of January. Michael Fassbender is with us. Ben in Sunderland. Afternoon all. Great to hear from Michael. I'm a great fan of Eden Lake and saw Hunger for the first time this week. I thought he and it was astonishing. What I'd really like to know is, what is he looking at in the top corner of the studio?
In here? How can you see us?
through these cameras. Through these cameras here.
Sorry, you're on television.
Oh, right. This top corner up here, I'm just looking at the various television sets.
Yes, there's the news channel and there's the cricket from South Africa. That's what he's watching. Someone else who's watching is Steve in Tyne and Wear, who says some random thoughts. One, Timothy Spall's hat was amazing.
Yeah, it was.
Was that a fedora he was wearing?
Yes, it was, but it was a bedraggled fedora, which was what made it cool.
Mm. I like that.
Characterful.
The bedraggled fedora, it's almost like a movie.
It's the name of a pub, isn't
or
it?
Or a band
probably owned by Guy Ritchie, the bedraggled fedora.
which people complain about. And number two, how does the good doctor use such a small laptop with such big hands? Well, it's an interesting point.
Do you think I've got big hands? Hold your hand up.
It's the world's tiniest laptop. Yep, you've got huge hands. Big, fat, chubby hands. That's what you've got.
Bass player's hands. Yeah. But beautiful in a strange way.
Richard Linklater, of course, you were talking about, was in here just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, he was.
To talk about?
To talk about me and Orson Welles and me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
strange choice of movie him to do. Actually, rather good.
And this from Sid, who says, he said, try to imagine, just on the Me and Orson Welles and Me.
Me and Orson Welles and Me.
Try and imagine Feeling Good was good enough for me, good enough for Bobby McGee and I. Or worse still, Mrs. Jones, Mrs. Jones, Mrs. Jones and I. We are currently conducting a clandestine relationship.
Isn't that a song called Me and Mrs. Jones?
Yes, that's why he's put
Okay, just wait while my brain catches up. I thought it was called
Ground.
No, I only mentioned it because I wrote the title of that film yesterday in a video roundup to do with Am I Black Enough For You, the Billy Paul thing. And I suddenly thought, I've got the title of it wrong. And it was a joke, sorry.
As you were. Yes, absolutely. Things you have to speak absolutely plainly, don't you? And Inglourious Ahem is the DVD which you can see Michael Fassbender.
Can I ask you a question about Inglourious Ahem, which is this. How come it is that Quentin Tarantino can direct individual scenes so brilliantly and orchestrate things like that scene when you're in when you're in the bar downstairs and everyone's talking across each other and it's all different languages and it's to do with accent and all that da 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 da. How come he can orchestrate all that stuff so brilliantly, and yet when it comes to the overall thing, he's just baggy in the extreme? I mean, somebody needs to stand over him with a stick and go, Quentin, you have 92 minutes like Reservoir Dogs, don't you think? I mean, they're individual.
Well, you think Michael is actually going to answer this question straight?
Actually, having met Michael once outside on the street with that mad guy who came up to you and asked you for racing tips,
I think
you might actually. Do you agree with me that Quentin is better on individual sequences than in overall structure nowadays?
I'm not sure if I agree with it. I know what you mean in terms of certain chapters I prefer to others, and I think definitely sort of hit it, just hit the sort of rhythm and have sort of perfect sort of synchronicity to them. I mean, it's hard to say. Reservoir Dogs is my favorite Tarantino film.
Stripped right down, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's sort of it's interesting, I think, as well, when you look at sort of low budget films and films obviously of a higher budget. And I know you're going to be talking about Avatar, but it's interesting when a lot of options are taken away from you and you have to make with what you just have.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess sometimes when you have a lot of options, that's the danger. But I think that all the chapters run really well in Inglourious. I prefer, for sure, the version that's out now, I think, is a lot tighter than the one that was in Cannes.
Yes.
For whatever sort of changes that they did, the tightness of each individual chapter is a lot more crisp.
And I'll remember Inglourious for another reason. That is, my eldest is 18 years old, and I went to see this 18 film with him.
On his birthday.
Well, I think there are very few 18 films that you'd actually choose to go and see with your 18-year-old. Yeah. But Inglourious is a perfectly fine choice. I mean, because it's basically just it's the Tarantino stuff, isn't it? It's scalping. And there's a lot of it.
I think as well, because, our expectations are so high of any Tarantino film that's coming out. You know, it's always hard to sort of hit that mark. But you know, again, sort of if you think about any other World War II film you've seen, it is in a sort of genre all unto itself, really. Yeah. And I was just watching the Kill Bill films there again.
Well, recently. They are bagginess incarnate. Yeah, they are really baggy.
But, you know, again, some of those moments
individual
are
sequences.
Just genius.
Yeah,
you know,
but that, Kissy, Kill Bill, yeah. Volumes 1 and 2. Yeah. Actually, I think that's the thing. It's like, yeah, look, I can't
I prefer
make
the second one.
Yeah, but I can't say
you've really stirred this up now.
Because, remember, you see, an intelligent, discerning gentleman. Yeah, there we go, you see. You know, the fact of the matter is, when Quentin said, I can't get this into one, he's obviously said it in an American accent, which I can't do, so I'm going to do him as Danny Dyer. He said, I can't get it into one film, right? I'm going to have two. They went, fine. No, somebody would have gone, no, it's the Roger Corman principle. Get the guy with the big stick to come in and go, 92 minutes and an exploding helicopter. After that, do what you want.
Yeah,
that didn't work for Lord of the Rings, though, does it? So
No, actually, that is the exception that proves the rule, isn't it?
Christian Munich, I saw Fish Tank at the Munich Film Fest, thought it was a great performance from Michael as Connor. It's a pity it didn't get a wider audience. It's my film of the year.
Although it did get an award at the Biffers recently. It is getting recognition.
What would be your film of the year, Michael? Something that you weren't involved with? I mean, I don't know whether you get a chance to see much other stuff if you're working so hard, but what have you seen that you thought, wow, love to have been in that?
It's a good question, actually. I haven't seen a great deal this year, in fact. I haven't really been going to the cinema an awful lot.
Well, I'm sorry to ask you the question.
Let me think about it. It'll come back to me. I haven't seen Avatar yet, no.
Have you seen any film in 3D that deserved to be in 3D or needed to be in 3D?
I think children's programs are actually getting like cartoons, I think, are coming sort of really, you know, to the forefront of film at the moment in terms of really taking it to another level. I found a lot of them really sort of, you know, well-rounded scripts that are entertaining for adults as well as kids.
You see, like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Yes,
that's a great script.
Yeah,
it was great.
Yeah.
And wasn't that like somebody made a David Lynch film but for kids?
Yeah,
the bit when they're in the cloud and the singing chickens attack them. That's so weird.
Brilliant.
So, Michael, what do we see you in? What do we see you in next? So this is out on DVD. The Inglourious film is out on DVD, and Fish Tank, I think, is out on the 25th of January.
Yeah.
What is the next big movie that we get from Herr Fassbender?
I'm not sure when Neil Marshall's Centurion is coming out. That'll be coming out sometime next year, I'd imagine, springtime. And then in the summer...
That's the one with
David Morrissey,
your next-door neighbour, isn't it?
Yeah, well
it's the one in which...
Exactly, but he's just always on the show. We just can't get rid of him.
David Morrissey said that apparently there was a photograph of him in that film in which he was so covered in blood and offal that his own child didn't recognise it as being a picture of him.
That's right.
Good old Neil Marshall.
That's right, knee-deep in snow and offal. That was a great cast again on that. Dominic West, who I've worked with a couple of times before... Olga Kurylenko, and again Liam Cunningham, who I'd sort of worked with again, and Noel Clark, and just a really good bunch of people.
And loads of blood.
Loads of blood and loads of chase, you know. It's basically a chase film. It's called Centurion, but we sort of called it Romans on the Run.
That sounds great. Kenneth Williams.
Exactly. Run for your life.
Charles Hawtrey, Sid James. They're all in there in the background getting slaughtered and covered in pig offal. Michael, great to have you on the show. Thanks very much indeed. Do you know what you're doing for Christmas? Is it?
I'm going back to Ireland on Monday. I'm going to spend about 10 days back there, then come back here for New Year.
Excellent. Well, really good of you to come on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Michael Fassbender.
Pleasure. Thanks.
Polish the award.
The award in his toilet.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure what we were talking about there.
So it's not a euphemism. Yeah. It just means...
That's Michael Fassbender. He's been polishing the award. Oh, right. Really? That's what I'd heard. Michael, thanks very much indeed. So Box Office Top 10 coming up. We're going to run down that. Avatar, of course, will be the big review. But we're also... Are you going to do Sherlock Holmes, even though it's not out till Boxing Day?
New Guy Ritchie film. I can't not do it.
Is that a yes or a no?
Yes.
Okay, Centrinians, we can do that?
Yeah, well, we'll romp through them, yeah.
Okay, but Avatar's going
to... We can do Avatar, we can do Nowhere Boy, because we're not on again until after Boxing Day.
But we have got to do it all in 45 minutes.
Well, we'll just be swift.
Have you ever been swift?
Well, it's a New Year's resolution. I will be swift.
No, you won't.
I will be swift.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Do you want to stay for the top 10?
Yeah, I'd like to stay for the top 10.
That's fine. But the point is, you can't contribute to it because you haven't seen any of them.
You might have done.
No, I haven't.
make it up.
But I'd like to hear it.
Fine.
Yeah.
Okay, well, what you'll have to do... That, okay, well, let's just zip through. And if you have anything to say...
I'll think of the favourite film of the year while you're doing that.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll say, all right, so there's a point in you staying. What, okay, you polished the award.
Up until that point, it was pointless, was it?
It's actually like Thirst. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
The Chow Yun Park.
Is that it?
Yeah. No, not Chow Yun Park. Park Chan Wook. Chan Wook Park.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Can you stop now?
Sorry.
Right, number 10 is A Serious Man.
Which has just been overlooked in the Golden Globes. Honk.
9 is The Box.
It's all over the shop and the last third of it doesn't work, but it is a partial return to form for Richard Kelly.
8 is 2012.
Which is total nonsense and utter rubbish, despite the fact that they've gone to great trouble to do the CGI special effects. It is a really mind-bendingly stupid and overlong film.
But quite fun. Law-abiding Citizen at number 7.
This is Sparta! Except it's not, but it kind of is.
Yeah. Do you know anyone who said that, Michael, in the past?
It rings a bell.
Does it?
Yeah.
That was my Quentin. I bet I do a better Quentin than he does.
Woody Allen's like, that's got quite a... Nativities at number 6.
Nothing like as bad as all the critics would have you believe. I mean, not a masterpiece by any means, but as a sort of vaguely cute kids film, it's perfectly fine.
Twilight Saga, New Moons at 5.
Leave her alone, she is neither wet nor drippy. I enjoyed that movie. I mean, I think the point at the end of it, when Michael Sheen turns up as the campiest king of the vampires in the world, is a spectacular moment, but I'm down with the New Moon Saga.
Yes, so there we have Paranormal Activity at number 4. Now, this is Ariel on this email. Dear Fathers Karras and Merrin, name is Ariel Packman, MBCHB. I am also reliably informed by my mother, who has produced a family tree. I'm Jason Isaac's cousin.
Really?
Although I've never met him. I'm writing in response to Mr. Kermode's plea to the public to explain why Paranormal Activity is as scary as it appears to be.
Why it's meant to be as scary as it appears to be.
I must admit that I felt very little fear whilst in the overcrowded and generally noisy cinema auditorium. It was only later when I returned to my dark and empty bedroom that the full horror of the movie struck me. It was the vulnerability that I think we all feel in bed that took effect... Really? I feel quite reassured in bed. That could be taken the wrong way. Took effect that the images I had seen earlier in the evening came back to give me an uneasy night's sleep. I actually had to escort my fair lady to the toilet that night and for many other in case that she was visited by a demon, which, really? Of course, is quite a commonplace occurrence if you go to the loo in the middle of the night.
Been visited by demons, yeah.
If you ever say hello to Jason, say hi from me, although he's never met me, and I hope he has heard of me as I have heard of him. So Jason will be listening on the podcast somewhere. Ariel Packman is your cousin, and is very good at escorting people
to the toilet. After having been scared by Paranormal Activity.
By paranormal demons.
Didn't scare me. But I mean, thank you for that explanation. I still remain to be explained.
Planet 51's at 3.
Which I liked. I mean, I got some rubbish reviews, but I thought the design of it was kind of cute. I like the idea of the aliens are the humans, and the humans are the aliens. And it's not Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which I think is pretty much my favourite animation of the year, even more than Up. I really liked it, but it's fine.
Where the Wild Things Are at number 2.
I like Where the Wild Things Are. And I heard a couple of people have emailed in saying, oh, blah, 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 you got this completely wrong. No, I like Where the Wild Things Are, and I think Where the Wild Things Are does work for kids as well. And I think there are too many adults, or too many adult critics going, oh, well, obviously it's not for kids. It is for kids. Fantastic Mr. Fox wasn't for kids. But Where the Wild Things Are is for kids. Kids understand trauma and all that stuff better than we do.
Vicky from Glasgow, dear Itsy and Bitsy, to escape the mind-numbing awfulness of a Sunday evening of reality television, I found myself sitting in a near-empty cinema watching Where the Wild Things Are. What a glorious film. Good. All the joy, the fear, the sadness, love, rage and endless imagination of childhood beautifully acted by Max and the Wild Things. Doesn't say much for the acting in the normal multiplex fodder that big hairy puppets could reduce me to tears. Watch and learn, Mr. G. Butler. Okay. At the end of the film... Pass that one on, Michael.
Sparta says no!
At the end of the film, I left with what could only be described as a ready-breck-like glow. It was great to be reminded of what it was like as a child to feel the absolute extremes of your emotions. Maybe in our sensible grown-up lives, we need to remember what that felt like. That sense of overwhelming joy of having a wild rumpus. Me, says Vicky, I'm off to run down a beach with a kite.
Very good. And I couldn't have said it better.
And number 1 this week is Disney's A Christmas Carol. So that's enough of that. Michael Fassbender, you've had a few minutes then to think of the film of the year.
Thirst. I told you before. It came to me just before we started.
Yeah, but you could have left then earlier, couldn't you?
I could have.
So nothing else
to stay.
Stay
for the 10. I thought it'd be rude to walk out midway through.
Do you want to stay for the Avatar review?
Yeah, sure.
He's not busy.
He hasn't got anything else.
He's got nothing to, he's
got nothing to do.
It's really lonely, cold outside,
for God's sakes.
Michael is our guest. He can stay as long as he wants. We finish at 4.
But after that, it's the mighty drive.
With the microphone.
But if you want to stay, if you want to stay and record your own show, then that'd be very good. So, Herr Fassbender just stays. We're going to do Avatar in just a moment. Thanks for all the emails on Avatar, because they open on Wednesday.
Are we going to start with Avatar? I'm very happy to do that. I was told to keep it. I'm very happy to. Let's just start with it.
Well, what's the
end
with it?
Okay, yeah, exactly. But I mean, actually, I'm happy. I think we should just, since we're there, I think we should just start with Avatar.
Right, so we're starting
with Avatar.
Yeah, thanks for the interruption. That was worth it. So CGI, emotion.
Yeah, the emotion. You do genuinely feel, and you relax into the idea that the creatures are, you know, that they're not CGI, you know, conjured things. They are actually there, and the facial expressions work very well. The Avatar, which is being driven, I think that's the only word we can use, isn't it? Being driven by Sigourney Weaver's character, does look like the Sigourney Weaver version, the alien version of Sigourney Weaver. And it's funny because when she breaks into a smile, because Sigourney Weaver's got such a distinctive smile, and the Avatar is based around the shape of her face, it is clearly Sigourney Weaver, despite the fact that it's a 12-foot blue alien with a totally different hairstyle. Okay, so that's very good. The second thing is that the world which Cameron creates, I mean, he, this famous thing about King of the World, you know, he's a world creator. It is true that the planet that he creates is a world. I mean, it is this lush, you know, vegetation, these extraordinary trees, plants, and you are in that world, and you'd really have to be pretty cynical to deny that Cameron has done, on a technical level, that idea of creating that world and putting you in it. He does, I mean, you are really there. And I know the joke about Ferngully in space, and I've made it myself. But hey, you know, there were things about Ferngully in space that actually sound like quite a good idea. So that's good. Second thing is, the story is hackneyed, in as much as we have heard the Pocahontas story before. We have heard the story about, you know, the military being the, you know, the horrible oppressive people. In fact, the way that we want to go is to be nice, because obviously there's an allegory with the Native Americans. There's an allegory with Vietnam. There's, I mean, there's, somebody else called it Dances with Wolves in Space. It is all those old stories that we know quite well. Going in and blowing things up, probably not good. Going in, being nice and looking after plants and the environment, probably good. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a groundbreaking argument, but I think it's a decent argument. As important, I think, is the issue of gender equality, because whatever else may be true of Cameron, he has always been very good, I mean, as an action director, on gender equality. You look back at things like Aliens, the defining image of Aliens is Sigourney Weaver holding Newt, looking up at the mother alien. And it is that thing about, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're male or female. In his movies, it's the female characters are often the toughest characters. That's also true of the Terminator movies. And in this, there is no sense that it's boys' action and girls staying at home. They are all equal. So whatever else may be true about Cameron, he is an equal opportunities action director. I mean, he does want to have it both ways. He wants the action and the blowing up, but he wants a pacifist action and blowing up, and also gender equality pacifist action and blowing up. So that's fine. So all those things I think are good. And if you go and see it, I think if you're a teenager and you go and see it because what you want is great big sci-fi spectacle, you are going to be pretty impressed. I mean, it is impressive. Those are the good things. On the downside, firstly, it is long and baggy, like so much of Cameron's work. It really needs to be pruned. I was saying this about Quentin Tarantino, but boy, does he need to rein it in. It's overwritten. An awful lot of the dialogue is terribly clunky, and things are explained, you know, from a great distance. Things are telegraphed up, and the dialogue does often read like quite poor comic book dialogue. People saying the really, really obvious in a way that they really don't need to. Secondly, there is a sense with all of this that the thing is so big that actually it somehow becomes heavy. It's funny that for a movie which is about, you know, the virtual reality of being in an avatar, and is about flying, and is about outer space, and is about new worlds, in fact, in which the central image is the gravity-less flying mountains, it's a terribly heavy movie. I mean, at times, it's like watching a huge ocean liner turning round 360 degrees. I mean, you're impressed by it because you're just impressed by the sheer mechanics of it, but you know that it's going to take an awfully long time for the bow to come round the other way. And because the plot, I mean, literally 15 minutes in, you could plan out the movie. You go, he's going to go to that side, she's going to do that, this is what's going to happen, that character is dying in that way, so that when that, you know, you really could plot the plot out.
Yeah, I mean, I just after I'd seen the film,
yeah,
explaining to the kids at home the kind of setup, and instantly they had worked out exactly what happened at the end without having seen any of it.
Exactly. And one of the problems with that is, and you know, I hate to invoke Friedkin here, but you know, Friedkin always used to say the thing about
don't,
because
it's
a good point. Was he always used to say, the audience is five steps ahead of you. So you really need to cut to the chase. You need to cut out all the shoe leather. Well, Cameron is the master of shoe leather. He's the guy who will film a scene, somebody opens the door, walks through the door. There's an awful lot of walking to get to the place that we know we're going to get to. And because you can see where the film's going, there are whole sections of it in which you just feel like you are, like Werner Herzog, you are literally dragging a mountain, dragging a boat up the side of a mountain, and it's a long way to get before you get to the top. That's a problem. The other thing is the whole idea about the immersive nature of the 3D. See, we were all told that the immersive 3D, this was going to be the thing that proved to us what 3D could do. It's not just pointy-pointy. It's not the pointy birds are pointy-pointy, anoint my head, anointy-nointy. It's something else. It's immersive. Now, Avatar is clearly the best 3D movie. It is the one that demonstrates what can be done with 3D, and it is an absolute demonstration of the fact that 3D is flim-flam. There are two ways in which you notice 3D, either when it's pointy-pointy spears, or when people are falling into ravines. It's good at pointing, it's good at falling. Beyond that, the immersiveness is nothing. And to prove it, I actually took the glasses off at one point to look at the screen out of focus, but to see what it looked like without seeing it through the glasses. And you know what? Even out of focus, because it was unrectified 3D image, it was every bit as impressive as it was with that. If you saw it on a big IMAX screen, if you saw it properly projected in a nice big cinema with a nice big sound system, you would have every bit the immersive experience of the 3D thing. But it is, I think, the defining point in the argument about 3D. You go, yes, that's what it can do, and that's done. There are moments in it in which it becomes... I mean, I never relaxed into the design of the creatures. I always found the creature design slightly too, you know, I know it's...
Designy.
They are too designy. And there are things about sometimes the trousers that they wear, the clothes they wear. It's just like, if you've spent all this money and all this time to create this incredible world, I kind of figure like you should have sorted out the creature design better. And there are moments in it, well, not moments, there are huge sections in it in which... everything stops so that people can explain everything to each other in ways that are quite toe-curling. But that said, I would be lying if I said, firstly, that I wasn't much more impressed than I expected that I was going to be. Secondly, that there aren't things in it that are, you know, genuinely quite breathtaking. And thirdly, that it did remind me that before Titanic, Cameron was a proper science fiction director. It's massively flawed, massively baggy, massively all over the place, but there was enough in it that you went, well, you know what? Wow.
Well, the correspondence is very interesting in picking up on some of those points, the wow points, the baggy points, the dialogue points, the acting points. Lots to discuss about Avatar, which came out on Wednesday. Loads of people have seen it already. Dave, first of all, dear Tango and Cash, saw Avatar at the IMAX yesterday. I have to admit, I was blown away. The negatives are obvious. Wooden dialogue, sentimentality of a 13-year-old girl. The burning horse creature was a great example of this. And a rather predictable story arc. But this did not take away from a film that had me sitting on the edge of my seat. I was in total awe at the majesty of what was happening on the screen in front of me. The 3D worked. The creatures seemed real. More importantly, though, it made me feel like a teenager again. I wanted to jump from those trees and fly the creatures on display. It was exciting and the time flew by. Unlike Lord of the Rings and Kong, says Dave. Another classic by Cameron, the first film of its type since Terminator 2. Dear Jake and Natiri, this is Martin Hager, BA, PhD, psychology. Just seen Avatar, long, cliched, predictable, but I loved it. The CGI and effects lived up to the hype. A truly spectacular visual epic and will take some effort to live up to. As for the narrative, it was reasonable, but it's not going to win any screenplay Oscars. Plenty of film references to boot. Matrix, Aliens, Lord of the Rings, to name a few,
Apocalypse Now.
That would be a good name for a show.
It would.
And War for Oil references. I'd like to see it again, as I think I lost a lot first time round in terms of acting. Sam Worthington did fine. Sigourney Weaver was excellent, but Stephen Lang stole the show as the deliciously evil Colonel. Johnny in Edinburgh. Just back from seeing Avatar in a sold-out cinema, I have to say that I really enjoyed it. At over 2.5 hours, it's not the shortest movie out there, but it's one that uses its length well. Time is taken to establish characters and motivation and to give us an emotional connection to the world of Pandora. As far as the issue of 3D is concerned, I'm not usually a fan of the medium, as too many directors use it as a gimmick to have objects coming out of the screen at you which add nothing to the movie itself. In this movie, the 3D was used to create a depth to the environment and not just to make the audience go, ooh.
Disagree with it.
Chris in Manchester, but you're wrong, did Big Cook and Little Cook, went to see Fern Gully, Sorry Mean Avatar last night on the huge IMAX screen in Manchester. The film was introduced by a smart young man with a microphone, whose film job appeared to be to tease the crowd with comments like, only 5 minutes to go before the film of the decade. Anyway,
that's probably me, wasn't it?
I'd summarise the film like this. 30 minutes of clunky dialogue and exposition while we get used to the 3D, then exactly 1 hour of Professor Cameron's technical demonstration where he shows off his newfangled filmmaking techniques. Finally, there's a good hour of fun, exciting entertainment at the end of it. All in all, I enjoyed it, but I couldn't help thinking that exactly a year ago I was sat at the very same cinema watching Star Trek, which for my money was a better science fiction blockbuster.
And actually, in its worst moments, this does turn into the Star Wars prequels, and that I think is something you need to bear in mind as well.
Loads of comments. There are some negative ones, but overwhelmingly people going, look, it's clunky, it's big, and it was long, it was baggy, but I had an absolute whale of a time.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, I'm not, you know, as I said, I'm not massively out of step with that, and I did go in with lowered expectations, as I think many people did, because of the poster and because of the trailer and because of what, you know, because of everything. And I did think that despite all the things that were wrong with it, and despite the fact I do think it's proof that 3D is a total non-starter, there is enough that's spectacular in there to make it, certainly it's worth going to see.
This is Jameson Miller in Tennessee, just back from a midnight showing of Avatar in Tennessee here on a real deal IMAX screen. The movie looks absolutely incredible. The 3D is unobtrusive and offers a genuine sense of depth. The middle part of the film drags a bit, but for the most part, it really was damned enjoyable, says Jameson.
Damned enjoyable.
And there were a few grisly deaths that are up there with that guy in Titanic who bounced off the propeller.
I forgot.
One kind of negative thing, Liam Mullen. Bishop VZ House plays Best Actor, 97 and 98. Saw Avatar last Wednesday. Whilst I will credit James Cameron with directing one of, if not the best-looking film yet to be made, he's also provided a film loaded with cliched characters, dreadful dialogue and a weak story. It aimed to be, Avatar aimed to be in the category of Birth of a Nation, the jazz singer and Citizen Kane as the film that changes everything. Instead, it must be placed in the tiresome white man enters foreign enemy dwelling and after initial scepticism quickly masters their own culture better than they themselves whilst also shacking up with the most attractive woman. Genre. Says Liam.
Very good.
But it's big.
It is. It's big, it's stupid. I mean, it is way too long, way too baggy, and there are moments that you just do want
but
to hit.
But you still said, wow.
No, I did. I did. It's, I mean, still because, wow. Because unlike I'm not cynical enough to say, no, yes, of course, there are things in it that are wow.
Is there anything else that might take our fancy?
Can I do very quickly, because there'll be a travelling too. I just want to very quickly say St. Trinian's 2, Legend of Fritton's Gold. I paid to this morning in Shepherd's Bush. It was one of those things in a multiplex cinema in which the projectionist sets the film running and doesn't even bother to look out the thing to realise that he's in the wrong ratio. So the heads are off the screen, the feet are off the screen, everything's still. I had to actually go out and say to the management, would you mind getting the projectionist to look at the screen and actually if he could project the image onto the screen, that might help? Then they did. So then I watched the
St. Trinian's. That was scary.
Well, then I watched the St. Trinian's. I said to them, it's in the wrong ratio. They said, what's ratio? I said, oh, for heaven's sake. Anyway, so then watched the St. Trinian's movie. They did. I then watched the new St. Trinian's movie, and you know how much I hated the first St. Trinian's movie? And David Tennant came in here, and he said, I'm in the new St. Trinian's movie. What do you think? I said, I hated the first one. I really hated it. Well, the second one, it's rubbish, right? But it's nothing like as objectionable rubbish as the first one. I mean, it is plodding and thudding, and the comedy is terribly wooden. But there are three laughs in it, all of which came from David Tennant. It looks to me like what's happened is this. The first one was very successful, and despite the fact that the first one had this really, I mean, uncomfortably fetishistic element towards it, which it seemed to be playing, I think, to the wrong crowd, it turned out to be a hit with teenage girls, and they've certainly, it looks to me like with this movie, they said, okay, you know what, let's make it much more for that audience. They've made it much more overtly, in inverted commas, in a Spice Girls kind of way, a girl power movie. Very clunkily done, but much less leery than the first one, therefore much closer to the kind of, you know, the ramshackle anarchy of the source material, though it gets nowhere close to it, but it is closer to it than the original was. David Tennant is funny, and I did laugh 3 times at David Tennant, and there were far less moments in it in which I thought, oh God, this is creepy as well as rubbish. I just thought generally it was rubbish with some laughs. So I have to say it's a quantum leap up from the first one, although I suspect it won't do as well.
A final bulletin from our parish notice board. As we said yesterday, we did a big farewell yesterday. It was a bit of a strange way to finish. A big farewell yesterday, and now here I am again today. And thank you for all the lovely messages. But as you know, Wittertainment continues every Friday in 2010 between 2 and 4. So Monday to Thursday, it's going to be in the hands of Gabby Logan and Richard Bacon, two first-rate, top-draw broadcasters. So all will be well. So we say thank you to all the team who have put this show on air since 2001, who have researched it and booked it and engineered it and produced it and edited it. Actually, speaking of editors, we mention Sally Collins, Mark Sandell, John Carey and Robin Bullock, who have, in their turn, sat in the big shiny chair and created this show from nothing, as they tell me every morning. Mainly, though, thanks to you for listening. As I said before, there were many who weren't too sure about putting another DJ on a news and sport network, me included. But it has been a fantastic 8.5 years, the longest I've ever hung around a programme for, and have interviewed some life-changing guests, inspiring women and men, thinkers, scientists, writers, actors, theologians, politicians, comedians, occasionally charlatans, crooks and vipers, and at least one murderer. And I'm now going to tell you who they all are. No, I'm not actually. But stop me and I'll tell you. Thank you for all the best wishes which have been coming in. They are in the process of being printed off and I'm going to give them to my mum. It's going to be her Christmas present because it's kind of cheap, but warm-hearted. And if you still want more, there is a best of this programme which goes out on Christmas Day, which is a week today.
It is.
Between 2 and 4. Some of your favourite bits and some of the bits you might have forgotten. Between 1 and 4, it's 3 hours of it, including the Billy Bragg and Bob Wilson and the Archbishop of Canterbury with Ricky Gervais and all that stuff. There. That's it. Anyway, but this
can I say in a brief break from tradition, and I'm going to stop. You are the best broadcaster in the country. Right, now let's get back to the abuse.
Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah,
you are the best movie reviewer I've ever heard.
Ever. Great.
Probably fine. In the history of movies.
Moving swiftly on, Sherlock Holmes. There's a new Guy Ritchie movie out. Okay, and over the years of this program, it's just kind of rather fitting. Actually, we're coming up towards the end with Guy Ritchie. So. The things that are, you know...
We always love Guy. We've never had a bad word to say about Guy.
We've had many, many bad words to say about
Numerology.
Guy.
Tell me
all about Kabbalah. Tell me... It was a load of Kabbalah. And when I was reviewing Revolver, I do remember saying that I did feel like throwing myself off the balcony, and it was like watching somebody set fire to their career. And there is something about Guy Ritchie that just inspires something in me that... I mean, I have had more bad times in the cinema with Guy Ritchie movies, but, you know, laugh out loud. Anyway, so now Guy has got his... geezery hands on Sherlock Holmes. Holmes and Watson. So the story is, for the new Sherlock Holmes movie, and you obviously know about it because you've seen the posters, you've seen the trailers, okay? So, Sherlock Holmes up against an adversary who is doing evil stuff, possibly from beyond the grave, with a kind of occulty flavour, which of course, that's fine, that's all sort of, you know, down to the source material. There is a lot more bare-knuckle fighting in this Sherlock Holmes than perhaps you would expect from the book. Apparently there is a lot, and I should say, I'm not an expert on the literary origins of this, but I am reliably informed that there is a passing reference that says, you know what, he was a bit tasty in a fight, and clearly this has been taken as an excuse. Yes, fine. So not only is he incredibly intelligent, but he's also, you know, fisticuffs, and the way they make it Sherlock Holmes is that when he's having the fight, the action stops so that he thinks through how to do the fights in a very logical fashion. So he's like a detective, but also a bare-knuckle fighter while stripped to the waist and doing all the Guy Ritchie stuff, okay? Holmes and Watson, played by Robert Downey Jr., who's, you know, up and down, and Jude Law, who's up and down. And therefore, all the things are in place for a car crash of a movie. Anyway, at the centre of the whole thing is a tension between Holmes and Watson, because Holmes has got himself engaged, because Watson has got himself engaged, and Holmes doesn't want to lose him. They're like a bickering old couple in which one of them is big-mouthed and full of himself
and
big hands and completely unable to pay the correct compliments to the other one. And the other one is the reasonable jelly who somehow holds it all together. Shall we hear a clip?
Oh, this sounds good.
There we go.
Holmes, as your friend... You've been in this room for 2 weeks. I insist you have to get out.
There's nothing of interest for me out there on Earth at all.
So you're free this evening?
Absolutely.
Dinner?
Wonderful.
The Royale?
My favourite.
Mary's coming.
Not available.
You're meeting her, Holmes.
Have you proposed yet?
No, I haven't found the right ring.
Oh, then it's not official.
It's happening. Whether you like it or not. 8:30, the Royale. Wear a jacket.
You wear a jacket.
It's like the best Christmas present, isn't it? There's a
Are
new
you
Guy
saying
Ritchie film.
I'm a reasonable jelly.
Yes.
Are you cracking your knuckles?
Because there's a new Guy Ritchie film out.
Okay, here we go then.
I liked it.
You know, I thought you were heading in that direction.
Did you?
I did.
You see?
I felt that you were backsliding.
I liked it. The funny thing is this, okay? Here's what I liked about it. Firstly, it's the least Guy Ritchie movie Guy Ritchie has ever made. And there's a lot of names on the screenplay, but none of them are Guy Ritchie. And although there are occasional moments when it sort of looks like it's about to go off into numerology, it doesn't. Because, I mean, if Guy, you know, that doesn't happen. That's point number one. Point number two, because of its setting, there really is precious little opportunity to get in geysery blokes, what do that? And they're called, you know, Jimmy the Snout and Mumbles. And okay, because there are characters who already have names. Plus, because of the setting, it's just there's not that much opportunity for that. Actually, the thing is designed rather well. It has the gothic look of those kind of fog-bound streets that entirely befits the movie. Because of course Sherlock Holmes is on that cusp of, you know, horror and crime thriller. In the same way that, you know, perhaps in Italy, you know, gialli is between horror and thriller. It's pitched quite right for that. In terms of the performances, Mark Strong, who plays the evil guy, plays him like Count Dracula, and he's great. He's really good.
He's usually good, isn't he?
Mark Strong is usually good, but in this, he's really good. And he takes a role which actually could have descended just into wanton caricature, and he makes the very best of it. And he's really, really good, and I liked him very much. There is much less of the camera goes very fast then stops, camera goes very fast then stops, camera goes very fast then stops, of which Guy Ritchie has been, you know, so enamoured in the past. Apparently they made it quite fast, and it looks like they did. It looks like it was kind of like, you know, crack on, get on with the thing. But the centre of it, and I am surprised to hear myself say this, is it has a very nice comic relationship between Holmes and Watson, because they are played as the bickering old couple who need each other and who fire off each other. I mean, they're in love with it. It is a love story. I know they've said this, but it is a love story about those two blokes. And actually, the central dynamic is that one of them is about to marry somebody else, and this is going to break up the relationship. There is also another love interest played on the side of Holmes himself, which is seems to have been put there entirely. Rachel McAdams seems to be put there entirely to, you know, as a sop to the American audience, and also as a sort of attempt to say, oh, it's okay because, you know, Holmes is straight. We all understand that. But actually, in those bickering scenes, in those scenes between them, there is something approaching genuinely good comedy. Now, as I said, I don't claim to be somebody who knows about the literary source of this. In fact, if you want a criticism of it from the point of view of somebody who understands literary source material, go and find out what Kim Newman has to say. I don't know what Kim Newman has to say, but if there's any basis for what's in the script, Kim will know about it. What I'm telling you is, as somebody who's never liked a Guy Ritchie film, never liked a Guy Ritchie film before, although, you know, first Lock, Stock, there were things in it, but, you know, after that it was all pretty much downhill. I went in expecting the very, very worst, and I started laughing, and I started enjoying their relationship, and I started thinking, you know, this looks quite good. You know, this is actually quite well put together. And I started thinking, yeah, this is, I'm not putting this on, I'm going with this film. I'm actually warming to the characters in a Guy Ritchie film. And through this strange collision of events that it had to make it fast and not his script, all these things came together and made a perfectly decent and perfectly passable and perfectly enjoyable action comedy with characters at the centre of it and a little domestic relationship played out against a gothic backdrop that I actually thought was visually interesting. So I really didn't think I'd end up saying that, but you know what? It's fine. Actually, at times, it's pretty
good. So we have a James Cameron big blockbuster, which gets a wow from you. I mean, a number of people thinking the kind of ground is moving beneath their feet. They're not quite sure of the future now as they contemplate a Guy Ritchie movie that you like and a Cameron movie that you like. And maybe the Christmas spirit is upon you.
No, because I still hate the other ones. I still think Revolver's awful. I still think Rock and Roller is awful. I still think there have been atrocious crimes. And there may well be atrocious crimes against cinema in the future. But, you know, but what it demonstrates is that I do watch these things with an open mind. But you know what? I enjoy it. Anyone who was in that screening with me will attest, I laughed a lot during Sherlock Holmes.
Well.
We should very quickly say,
Happy Christmas to Stephen Fry, David Morrissey, Jason Isaacs, Fairport Convention, Michael Sheen. By the way, Michael Sheen, if you heard the kind of little kind of tributey nice things about the programme sequence, which is on the end of the programme yesterday, that is now a video sequence and you can see that online.
Okay.
Yes.
I was going to say, we should say Nowhere Boy is out on Boxing Day. You talked about it before. I have now seen it. I think it's pretty good. I think that there are things in it. I mean, it's a very difficult to follow Ian Hart's performance in Hours and the Times and Backbeat as John Lennon. But I think there is a good movie in there about the relationship between the central character and the woman that he thinks is his mother and the woman that he thinks of as his aunt. And it generally avoids all the clunky steps into which those kind of biopics fall. We will talk about it more, I'm sure, in the new year. But Nowhere Boy I thought was pretty satisfactory. I thought it was, you know, it's not, I don't think it's, I think it lacks the violence or the potential violence of the Ian Hart performance, but I think there's enough in there to enjoy, and I thought it was pretty handsomely done.
So on Christmas Day, which is a week today, you get a best of this programme over the last 8.5 years. That's going to happen. You can get some Wittertainment on New Year's Day when we review the best of 2009, best stuff that we've enjoyed in various rants, various interviews and so on. And then we're back live whenever, the 8th.
8th.
Friday the 8th, between 2 and 4 o'clock. Movie of the week. Avatar. It's Avatar. Avatar is the movie of the week.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, me again. To watch my latest reviews, take a trip to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode for the Kermode Uncut blog.